Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
I'd
say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them,
won't we? What you doing down here, you shawny man?
I was accused during Francis Murphy's Guide to the Weekend Sport on TV last Friday of doing a massive hype job on the Milan Derby while working on Premier Sports promoting their coverage of the match. I was accused by Kieran Murphy as opposed to Francis Murphy about this. Anyway, I got to admit, I bought into my own hype job yesterday, decided I'd forget about whatever Premier League was on at the time and just watch a bit of Serie A instead. And as I sat there, transfixed by Romelu Lukaku taking a ball down in the centre circle, powering past some Milan defenders and coolly slotting home the third goal of a 3-0 win for Inter before celebrating like a man who had just won his personal duel with Zlatan Ibrahimovic, I sat there and thought to myself, maybe I didn't hype this up enough. Welcome to Monday Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hi, Murph.
Hey, On. I know what you were thinking. You were thinking, bloody hell, if there's a football fan out there who isn't subscribed to Premier Sports right now, what are those clowns thinking?
Hi, Ken.
Oh, and how are you?
I know from reading your Irish Times piece this morning, Ken, that you noticed the same detail as I did after that third goal was scored. And that was this... There was a slow-mo shot of Zlatan gritting his teeth and clapping his hands together after Lukaku scored that goal. I took it to be in a sort of, come on, lads, we can still do this kind of a way. But
or at least, yeah, I've got to act as though we can still do this, yeah. Even though I know we can't because I am the leader of this team of nobodies.
But the commentator read a lot more into it. He said, there's Zlatan applauding the goal by Lukaku. For all his many faults over the years, he's always been honest enough to admit when he's been bested. I just thought that was quite generous, considering the last time the teams played, Zlatan was involved in a feud with Lukaku. I'd have to say, hats off to the big man if that's what it was. If what he was saying there was, congratulations, Romelu, you're the king of this city now.
And I'm pretty sure the commentator was reading things that weren't there. It is Zlatan's reaction. I don't think he's ever really been the type to salute his salute, you know, as the beaten opponent, to sort of turn around and applaud those who have beaten him. It's just not his way. It's not really the way of the great players. Let's face it. You know what I mean? They tend not to do that,
particularly an aging great player who is being bested by a man many years his younger, who looks like he's got a bright future in the game. I'm talking about Lukaku, as though he's 19. I mean, he's well into the peak years of his career now, but he's got a lot fewer miles on the clock than old Zlatan.
He's 27, but he's still like 12 years younger than Zlatan. So, you know, Zlatan is 40 in October, I think. The fact that he's still doing this, he should be happy just to be still doing this. I mean, has he scored more goals than Lukaku? I think he may have, actually, in Serie A this season. But in this game, there was no doubt who came out on top, because it wasn't just the goal. And the goal was a real, like... he burst from the halfway line. And he didn't actually have to necessarily beat a player because he just sort of ran in a straight line, but much too fast. I think Romagnoli was the core. I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of these Milan players are a little bit interchangeable. You know, you've got Donnarumma at the back and Zlatan at the front. And then in the middle, it's kind of like, this could be anyone. You know, this could be Rotterdam or anywhere, right? This, who are these guys? Inter were more, you know, have a more recognizable lineup, I guess. But Lukaku, as I was saying, he just sort of ran. And then he got close enough to goal that he was able to just hammer it in with his left foot. But he'd also created the first goal with a brilliant cross. Yeah. You know, he's very good at that cross.
Yeah.
There's a particular cross that he's good at. In fact, he can do outside of the foot as well. I've seen the guy could do a couple of nice outside of the foot crosses. But when he gets into that area around the corner of the box, particularly good at the in-swinging left-footed cross.
Yeah, so this is on the right-hand side of the box. So he's on it coming in on his left foot and just chipping it across. One of those crosses that probably aren't that easy to do, where he's having to get it up and down in a relatively short space, but he did it quite well.
Yeah, whipped it over the head of Seaman Kerr, it was. To Lautaro Martinez, who he couldn't miss. Well, he could miss. He could have missed. I've seen players miss, but in this occasion, it looked like he could miss, and he didn't. So fair play.
Lukaku has 17 goals in Serie A, having played 7 more games than Zlatan Ibrahimovic, who has got 14 goals. Just FYI, Ken.
Yeah.
I know I'm here only to facilitate the football show, and that's what I'm doing here, just facilitating speedy delivery of these statistics.
Thank you for that correction. I would say that I, you know, a lot of the time these days, I'm tending not so much to look at absolute numbers, but at per 90s.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that might be how that crept in.
I wouldn't even call it an error. Wouldn't call it an error. Just call it a misunderstanding between me and the listeners and you.
No. I mean, just to be clear, it's not an error.
Well, I mean, technically it's an error, sure.
No. Technically, it was a question. No. Technically, it was a question. Has Lukaku scored? Has Ibrahimovic scored more goals? You know, I thought it was a tentative hypothesis.
Yeah.
You know? And thanks to me asking that question, we now have the answer.
The information. Yeah.
More tentative hypotheses to come with Jonathan Wilson and Dion Fanning. We're going to talk to them about the Premier League stuff, including Everton's first win in a Merseyside derby at Anfield this century. There's more Champions League during the week, of course, including Atletico Madrid against Chelsea. You're going to have to be signed up to the World Service to hear our coverage of that. And you can sign up in just a couple of minutes on secondcaptains.com. We're also going to bring you a second shorter Monday podcast today. That one will be available for everyone a little bit later on. Right now, it's Report on Sport time.
The commentator you mentioned, Ellen, on Premier Sports, your colleague, put forward another tentative hypothesis in his. He's like, you know, can Lukaku be Ballon d'Or? To which I immediately thought, no.
Why not?
Clearly not. Well, actually, in fact, he said, didn't he? If he, you know, sort of fires Belgium to Euro's glory, which was the kind of confounding thing. Yeah, maybe. But I kind of think always, if you want to win the Ballon d'Or, you can't get knocked out in the group stage of the Champions League. It's never a good, you know, it's never a good start. The international tournaments can change things a little bit. Maybe if Inter wins Serie A, and it looks like they're going to. Although, you know, again, Serie A. This is the league in which Zlatan Ibrahimovic continues to captivate in his 40th year. But mainly I just sort of thought, well, it's going to be difficult when there's already players who appear to be better than him. I mean, and I hear that you read my Irish Times article. Mm. What did you think of the tentative hypothesis about Mbappe and Haaland?
So maybe fill our listeners in on this, Ken. I'm sure most have.
Well, it's a good timing for me, really, because just to write an article saying, you know, actually Mbappe is just way better than Haaland, and there's really no comparison between the two as footballers. Mm. On the weekend, when Haaland smashes in another 2 goals in a barnstorming Dortmund revere derby win, while Mbappe is neutered by Monaco, his old team, as PSG lose limply. Mauricio Pochettino's PSG, of course, losing limply to Monaco, and aren't even, well, I think they're third in the league at the moment.
Well, I have to say, I did have Sid Lowe, I should say, in my head a little bit, having talked to Sid on the World Service last week on Wednesday, wasn't it? It was after he'd witnessed Kylian Mbappe score his hat-trick, and we put it to, is he the greatest player in the world? And Sid wanted to go with us on that, but didn't totally commit. You know, it wasn't one of those ones he goes, absolutely, undoubtedly, he's better than Haaland, he's better than everybody. But, you know, he kind of politely went along with that. Then I saw him tweeting the next day and reporting from the Sevilla match where, Haaland was absolutely ridiculous. And I got a sense he was more committed to his Haaland praise than he had been to his Mbappe praise. But Sid's not here to answer those questions right now, Ken. I just felt that was somewhat in my head when I was then reading your article and you were going the other way and saying it's definitely Mbappe.
PSG are third, by the way. Just well done, Ken.
Oh, right, okay. So you just sit there just checker. Checking everything
yeah,
I
no,
say.
Yeah, I'm just going to fact check everything you say.
Okay, right, okay. Well, no, it's good. Yeah, that's great. No, I was just looking at Haaland. I was like, I don't understand what this guy does. Like, I don't get it. Like, I can see what he does.
He just bullies people. Like, it's, you know, I think we were talking about it last week as well. But, I mean, he's just, like, the size of the guy. Like, it's scary when he gets up ahead of speed. Like, it's get out of my way.
Yeah. He you know, they have on FB Ref, which is a very good stats website, they've got that thing where you can kind of... it shows you play, you know, like on Spotify where they have like go to song radio where they will play you like songs that are like the song that you're playing. Well, I suppose it's like player radio. Like if you put Haaland in and press the button, you know, I mean, this is, you know, this is obviously sort of old hat in algorithmic terms, you know, these types of generate. If you like this, you might like, you know, so on. Did, I mean, it was maybe new when the guy at Arsenal, remember Sven Mislintat was signing Luca Torreira because he'd put Kante into his system and like press the button, like find me another Kante. And they signed, they were like, what about this guy Torreira? And he's like, buy him. So obviously these things aren't perfect. You know what I mean? But FBRF scouting system, you know, you can bet if there's a player in there, it shows you players who they're most like. Which English Premier League player is most like Erling Haaland, according to their song Player Radio feature. It's not called, which is not called Player Radio.
Are the
compared
the
to other
facts and figures?
Other
are
forwards.
The facts and figures okay? Are the facts and figures just like game involvements, not like physical attributes or anything like that?
No, it's basically what all the stats of what they've done, all their performance data. It's not like I don't think the fact that he's like 6'4" would have anything to do. Although, to be honest, I haven't actually read the little thing of how these likenesses are created. So maybe they do. Okay. Maybe there is.
Well, I was going to say Jamie Vardy.
That's the correct answer.
Oh, well done, right. Murph.
I just feel on it today.
Yeah, you are on form.
Hang on a second. But when you say you're on it, is the it you're on the FB Ref similar
no.
to players'
no,
page?
No.
You're going to say Jamie Vardy. Why did you say Vardy?
Absolutely. Because he does nothing except score goals.
Yeah, well, you are right. I'm Vardy. Vardy sets up the odd goal as well. I think.
A more polite way would be to say he comes alive in the final third, Murph. That's the way that's a euphemism.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no, I mean he doesn't show any major interest in, you know, three or four different involvements in a move before he scores a goal. He just gets into the position where he thinks he can score a goal, and more often than not does that.
Yeah. Well, Jamie Vardy is the right answer, which is pretty interesting. You know, which kind of shows, I suppose, what a pure striker he is. But what I found amazing was looking at his stats, they'll give you like their sort of performances in percentile terms. You know what I'm? You know, if I say that Haaland is in the 17th percentile for passes completed, you know what this means? Alan? This means that he is equal. That 83% of players, 83% of forwards, because that's what he's being compared to, will play more passes than him in a game.
I understand.
If he's in the
17th
percentile. Okay. The 13th percentile for passes attempted. Like, you know, this is like really.
But he doesn't.
Low.
Yeah, but he doesn't attempt passes. He gets the ball and he runs. Is that not part of his appeal?
Well, he doesn't run that much either. I mean, he's a below average dribbler. Like, you know, he dribbles less than sort of, where is he? He's like the 49th percentile for dribbling, and then slightly less than that for like completed dribbles.
I thought he might be a bit higher up on those percentiles actually,
because when he does dribble it makes such a massive impact. It's like, oh my god, I've never seen, you know, there are some players who do that. Like Mbappe is a player who also does that. Like if you remember the France-Argentina game from the 2018 World Cup, I don't know if you have clear memories of the game, but there's one moment of the game, the first decisive moment of the game, which stands out in my memory, which is Mbappe's run from his own half into the French penalty area for a penalty, where he got the ball like literally in the middle of the French half, sort of tore away from three Argentina players all chasing him in the centre circle. He just gets away from them. You know, he's up against the defender then. He knocks it past the defender, runs past him and is brought down, and it's a penalty, which France scored to go 1-0 up. But it was just a run. You're like, my God, look at this. Like, this is incredible to see somebody do that in a World Cup quarterfinal. Like, to dominate players, opponents of that sort of level. It lives in my memory long after almost everything in the match. I mean, what else? I remember Pavard scoring. I remember Pavard's weird goal. Like, you remember that nice volley that he scored. Argentina sort of got... Didn't Di Maria score a great goal in the game as well?
I can remember Argentina actually very nearly equalising near the end. They had a great chance
with
a header.
Right.
And the wrong player took it. There was one... Somebody was waiting to just nod it in, and another player came across and boop, bang, header wide. Which is what easy to forget, considering it kind of felt as though they'd fallen apart.
Yeah. And they did. They were ahead. They were ahead just after halftime. But look, we didn't come here necessarily to talk about a France-Argentina game from 2.5 years ago. The point is that with someone like Haaland, what he does is he makes an outsized impression given what he actually is doing in the game. And the thing that I was most surprised by was how low down he is in terms of receiving the ball. Because receiving the ball is one of the absolutely key skills of football, and one of the things which maybe is least appreciated by spectators. You know what I mean? That we kind of have a tendency to go, oh, you know, he didn't get involved in the game, or, you know, oh, you know, where was he? He's hiding or something like this, right? Without maybe sometimes grasping the work and the skill that's involved in being available to get the ball, being available to receive passes. Like, say, for instance, that's one of the things that was always said about, that was what Mesut Ozil was so brilliant at, right? One of the reasons that Mesut Ozil was brilliant, I mean, there's all the things that you can see him doing, like his touch on the ball is kind of really perfect, the way that he moves around, the weight of his passing and so on and so forth, but also the fact that he was always available to receive a pass somewhere between the lines. Or at least this is a thing. Well, I mean, I'm aware that I've prefaced this by saying, oh, he was hiding, he went missing, which are also the things that were said about Ozil. But apparently, this is one of the things he's really good at, receiving the ball. Now, Erling Haaland, crazily, is for pass targets as a stat on the FPRF, which is basically how many times is this player the target of an attempted pass? How many times do his teammates try to pass him the ball per game? He is in the fifth percentile for this. The fifth percentile. So 95% of forwards are the target of more passes from their teammates than Erling Haaland, right? 38 passes per game, fifth percentile. The 11th percentile for passes received, and the 24th percentile for passes received controlled, right? So that's 3/4 of players are doing better than him. Like, for pass received, 90% of forwards are getting more passes than him.
Ken, you never mind ask me who's the Premier League striker that he's most like. He's the anti-Didzy McGoldrick.
Yeah, he literally is. Like, they are yin and yang. Like,
it's unbelievable. He's 100% a polar opposite of Didzy McGoldrick in every conceivable way.
Every conceivable dimension. But like, that to me is amazing. That, because all of this has to be considered in the context of this player is scoring goals at a rate that's never been seen before. Right, to use the phrase of Donald Trump, a man whose tweets he has previously liked a number of, like you've never seen before. You know, if I look at, like, you know, I've talked a lot about some obscure sounding stats. Oh, passes received. Like, you know, who cares about that? What I mean is, if you were to look at, say, Mbappe is like the 98th or 97th percentile for all of these types of things. Like, you know, if you look at the top forwards, you know, Ronaldo, Messi, Neymar, Zlatan, they're all in like the top couple of percentage points for in these types of areas. And Haaland's nowhere near. Like, he's just got no involvement in the game by comparison to these guys. There is one area in which he's completely dominating. If I look at the Champions League, goals. Who's number one in goals in the Champions League this season? Yes, it's Erling Haaland at 8 goals. Goals per 90, Erling Haaland, 1.66. Goals and assists. Who's top of that stat? Yes, it's Erling Haaland. His goals and assists for 90. Yes, it's Erling Haaland again. Non-penalty goals. That would be Erling Haaland. Non-penalty goals for 90. Yeah, that's Erling Haaland. Yes, non-penalty goals plus assists per 90. Yes, that's Erling Haaland. Expected goals. That's actually Lionel Messi, but level on him at 4.9 is Erling Haaland. So, expected goals per 90. That's Erling Haaland again. So, like, what? This is just kind of crazy. Like, I really don't sort of get it. Like, Mbappe is like a kind of a classically brilliant player in exactly the way that, like, you've seen. In fact, we were saying he looks exactly like a brilliant player of days gone by in Ronaldo. He kind of reminds me of him, the way that he moves, the way that he plays, the things that he does. I'm like, oh, this, to me, this is beautiful, because it sort of reminds me of the circle of life. Ronaldo has been reborn. Like, he's not dead. You know, he's out there. He's fine. But he is retired. As a footballer, he's finished. But here he is again. He lives again in the shape of, we never really lose these things. They're only, they get reborn again into the footballing world. Isn't it a beautiful thought? Haaland is like, what is this? Honestly, Haaland is like the beginning of the Terminator movie, where the metal foot crashes down on the human skull. And maybe that's a negatively charged image. an unduly negatively charged image. But in terms of...
I was thinking more of that portrait of Kramer in Seinfeld. He's a loathsome, repulsive brute, and I can't look away.
nobody can look away, because almost every time he touches the ball, he's smashing it into the net. Like, it's honestly...
Well, Sid couldn't look away. I got the tweet that I was referring to earlier on. Watching Haaland live tonight was so different to watching him on the telly when he's also good. Just brutal. The sense that everyone and everything hangs on him, the panic, the way he seems to surge and warp everything. Wow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, but he's used the word brutal. Now, I don't know if he's using, because I know that that's a word that's used in a slightly different way in Spanish, right? They kind of say brutal when they mean, or they say like barbaric when they mean like really good. Haaland does, I mean, I've compared him to the Terminator crushing a human skull, which is unfair on the lad. You know, he doesn't deserve that type of talk. But what I mean by that is he feels like something different. Like, I can't remember seeing a guy like that with this strange, super pared down style of play. I mean, this is kind of how Ronaldo, remember, sort of developed a lot as a player into this very narrowly sort of fixated goal scorer, right? When you consider Ronaldo is the classic player when he arrived at Man United. Remember his first performance against like Millwall or whatever he came was no it wasn't Millwall it was the cup final it was I can't remember was it Bolton maybe at Old Trafford his debut came on for the last half hour and like wowed everybody with like an unbelievable display of stunts. An amusement arcade would have been like the phrase that Ron Atkinson would have used about him. Ron, of course, was still just about doing TV commentary in 2003 when this match happened. But he, over the years, kind of evolved, started just concentrating on the things that like, you know, fewer sort of just tricks for the sake of it. And sort of the last couple of years, he's almost just been a pure goal scorer. It's like Haaland has just started off from that point. And like, is just refining. Just forget all the everything else is bullshit. Just give me the ball and let me kick it into the goal. So, anyway, I honestly didn't mean to speak about them for that long at this point.
It's okay. It's been done. What do you want? Do you want to give Everton some props?
Yes. Well, let's go straight to the Everton dressing room, thanks to their reserve left back Niels Nkunku. So that's everyone getting pretty excited. People have said, well, you know, is the atmosphere sort of lacking in this pandemic behind closed doors football? Make your own atmosphere. Is the Everton mentality.
You could see it. You could see it on the pitch afterwards. Big Dunk was a presence. He was straight over to our Seamus. And, you know, they were all just celebrating as though there may as well have been fans there. They were that excited.
I see Seamus hasn't had anyone around to do his hair by the looks of it. He's... mop-topped right back. You know, for a man of his advancing years, Impressive growth.
Yeah, no, he's doing well.
Still there. We know that Father
we
Time.
We say that. That's in relation to match report from last week, wasn't it? Where it was.
It was the athletic.
Yeah. Old man Coleman turns back time.
Coleman even sounds a bit like Oldman, right? I mean, it
rhymes with Hans Molman.
Hans Molman. So look, well done to him,
Hans Coleman,
because Hans Coleman, who absolutely snuffed Andy Robertson, the player who's had more touches than anyone else in the top five leagues, Andy Robertson. But they were all ineffectual against Everton, fumbling fruitlessly against that rock-solid Everton defence. And Coleman, after doing the interviews as well, you know, the mindset has changed. It's not about competing with Liverpool. It's about being successful in our own right. I keep saying it. I know it's boring. I'm sure the lads are fed up of hearing it. Stop apologising for your pep talk, Seamus. On a day-to-day basis, we have to be professional and keep doing the right thing. Okay, it is boring. And keep doing the right thing. And hopefully success can come to the football club. Seamus, that is boring. But look, it is the right message. We can't turn it on and off like we have in the last 3 or 4 weeks. Look, absolutely. The lads know what you mean, and you have to try out these things for the media. We saw how you really felt. I mean, when you're saying these things in the dressing rooms, your eyes blazing, that's when it isn't boring. You know, that's when it doesn't matter what the words are. What matters is the fire in the eyes. So that's what
he talks about himself like he's 40. You know, the way he describes himself is like, because you're right, he says that a lot. He kind of says, "Yeah, I've been saying it to the lads," but it's almost as though he's been. Well, I suppose has been there an awful long time, and has a lot more experience of what it means to be an Everton player than. The rest of them.
But he also had a pop at Klopp, I think.
Yeah,
I mean, again, it's one of those where people can overhear what the players are saying at the games, you know, because it's obviously nobody there. And one of the journalists there, and again, I forget which one, I saw the tweet that was saying something like, you know, Duncan Ferguson and Klopp had gotten to some altercation where Klopp shouted something, for example, like, oh, what are you doing, or what's your problem, or something along these lines, to which Coleman on the pitch shouts from the pitch, "Oh yeah, are we allowed to talk here, Jurgen, or is it just you?"
No.
We're allowed to talk as well, Jurgen, are we, or is it just you?
You'll do it again.
So
he's spiky, we do know that.
Put big Jurgen back in his big box. Big Jurgen, of course, has got a few problems. Jordan going down. Jesus. Groin injury. Seems like he might be out for 5 games or so. They've got big games in that 5 games, including one against Chelsea, obviously against Leipzig, the return match of the thing. Although, you know, I also have to say, Jordan Henderson's been playing centre-back in a lot of games recently, and Liverpool lost most of those games. So, I mean, I think it might have been kind of time to sort of have a look at changing that anyway.
Well, yeah, depending on the options. I mean, the replacements. Mm. Does Nat Phillips fill you full of confidence? I'm not 100% sure.
Oh, I don't understand why Nat Phillips... Like, I honestly haven't seen Nat Phillips do much wrong. I mean, in the case of the... Obviously, Nat Phillips wouldn't be the fastest centre-back. Neither is...
Yeah, I've seen him struggle. I saw him struggle a little... Exactly, yeah, the two of them together. I saw him struggling a bit against Callum Wilson. I mean, not, by no means, it was...
That's right.
But he did it like Wilson kind of. I certainly, you know, there was a sense he was any chance there was to go at him and to rough him up and to get a run at him, he was bloody well taken. Now, Callum Wilson's a really, 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 really good striker, but there are a lot of really, really good strikers in the upcoming matches for Liverpool. So you do have to be
ready
for that.
Imagine Timo Werner might fancy a run at Big Matt. But yeah, I mean, again, you know, Henderson's played centre back 9 times. Their record in those games is 3 victories, 5 defeats. A couple of heavy defeats as well. So, you know, I mean, maybe this is even worse, but like, it's already pretty bad. So,
we're going to talk more about this, about Liverpool and about Everton in a few minutes' time. So, where else do you want to go here?
Thomas Tuchel, he is not messing about. We were talking about David Moyes at Old Trafford putting on and then taking off Mipo Adebeko. Well, I mean, Thomas Tuchel has done the same to Callum Hudson-Odoi. But it's not even so much what he did in terms of... like, at least when Moyes took off Mipo at Old Trafford, he kind of downed... Like, it was sort of like, yeah, we're not going to talk too much about that afterwards. He's like, look, you know, it's great for the lad to get minutes. And he sort of was quite diplomatic. Tuchel just absolutely blasted Hudson-Odoi. Like, We brought him in. I wasn't happy with his attitude, his energy, and counter-pressing. I took him off. We demand 100%. I feel he's not in the right shape to help us. We can't play at 99%. It's not possible. Playing the Premier League, this is our standard. Our demand to ourselves is to be 100% sharp. I talked to Calum and the whole group. It's absolutely not a big thing for me. You saw Hudson-Odoi coming off. It was like, oh my God, it's such a disgrace. If people want to talk about it like it's a big thing, okay, for me it's not. It's on Calum to show he's a reliable guy when he comes to the bench. So he's basically saying, look, this is, I'm just, you know, it's nothing personal. I'm showing Hudson-Odoi the standard. He has to be aware of them. Apparently he wasn't there. That wasn't good enough. I'm not going to put up with it.
Do you know what was especially interesting? I thought that it wasn't as though he hadn't actually even asked about Hudson-Odoi yet. That answer came from a question about Abraham. Hudson-Odoi was mentioned in the question. It was like Hudson-Odoi came on for Abraham. Was Tammy injured at halftime? And so he managed to have a bit of a pop at Tammy as well. He goes, no, not an injury. Tammy couldn't put a stamp on the game, basically. So we brought in Hudson. But then Hudson, and then he goes into the rest of the answer you have about Hudson-Odoi. So it was totally something he wanted to say very much, you know, like I'm gonna show my teeth here a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I suppose if you're going to do something like this, you might as well do it at the beginning, you know. And with a player, Hudson-Odoi, on one hand, you could say, well, Hudson-Odoi is quite a young player for you to be sort of trampling on to show your authority, Thomas. But on the other hand, Hudson-Odoi is a player he's sort of brought into the team and given much more responsibility than he had under the previous two managers. So, you know what I mean? Like, he's... I don't know. I think he's still in the phase where he can do these types of things. I mean, obviously, when you just do these things to a player, it is the kind of thing that can create bad feeling. But I think in the way that he handled it, he was kind of so straightforward about it. He was sort of so like, he didn't sort of dance around it. He was just like, yeah, that wasn't good enough. Like, I mean, I'm not going to put up with that. So if he wants to give me more bullshit performances like that, like, you know, we won't be seeing much more of him. So next question, you know. So,
It is kind of weird, you know, like obviously Hudson-Odoi felt like deeply insulted by it, you know. But there was a Galway hurler in the 2012 drawn All Ireland hurling final. Conor Cooney was brought on after 52 minutes, taken off 8 minutes later. Yeah. Like, it happens, like, it does happen.
8 minutes is not a long time. Did something else happen in the game, like someone get injured and they had to tactically?
No. It was a tactical substitution. Taken off after 8 minutes. It was actually by the guy's neighbour. Like, they're from the same parish. Anthony Cunningham, the manager, Conor Cooney, the hurler in question. I mean, it does happen quite a bit.
Did they at least have a bag of ice waiting for him in the sidelines over here?
Yeah. Like, you want to limp off there. But, yeah, I mean, like... I mean, that's an extreme version of what happened to Hudson-Odoi, but I mean, you kind of have to suck it up, don't you? Like, if you've been given half an hour to perform and you haven't performed, I mean, what can you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Thomas Tuchel is already what, 1 month into his 18-month contract, so one down, 17 to go.
He knows the clock's ticking.
Now, just lastly, obviously, we had a match, high noon, we referred to it as, on Sunday. Now, we know how it is. You have success in the past, and then in the present, things happen that confuse people, bewilder people. They don't understand what's going on. A lot of the journalists, people like, you know, Miguel Delaney or whatever, were saying things ahead of this, ahead of Jose Mourinho's Tottenham going into battle against West Ham and the high noon fixture, were saying things like this.
Connect that is ideas. Methods became unsound.
So that's the kind of talk that was surrounding Jose going to the game, you know, people talking about his methods. And here's audio from his post-match interview with Sky Sports.
They told me that you had gone totally insane. And that your methods were unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
I don't see any method at all.
Wasn't it? It's okay. So that's good, isn't it? No. What, you know, what's all this about? Well, of course, it's Jose used the word methods, didn't he? That's the basis of all that. He used that word, methods.
Mm.
Because sometimes the results are consequence of multi situations in football. And mine and my coaching staff methods are second to nobody in the world.
Yes, that's Jose Domenico's methods. Methods are second to none in the world. Results not so good.
Those methods are I wouldn't be questioning those.
Well, you know, I mean, he's like, it's multifactorial, isn't it, Owen? You know, it's multifactorial. You know, there's a lot of things that can go on. I mean, the methods are beyond question. I mean, it's like the man says.
He fears my methods because he doesn't understand my methods. You know, human nature, the unknown, sure. But relax, you know. I don't want all this, what are you doing? What are you doing? How are you doing it? No. Judge me by my results.
Or maybe actually don't judge him by the results. The results are bad. The point is that there's a lot goes into making those results. It's not all about the coach. Sure, the coach gets paid a lot. But at the same time, other things have to go the coach's way, and you can't simply blame the coach for everything. Roy Hodgson, Owen, saying the same thing. Roy Hodgson, I mean, I know that you've seen a lot of Crystal Palace this year. The form hasn't been great, has it?
Nah, bit up and down.
People, more down than up, though. Yeah. Be saying, you know, eight wins, 12 defeats. That's more down than up. Out of both cups in the first attempt. And people apparently had started. Obviously, you can't have a situation where the crowd is angrily demanding the removal of Roy Hodgson. Although, I don't know if you saw the footage from outside the San Siro. There was like thousands of people turned up outside the San Siro for the Milan Derby. Yeah. You're kind of like, what is the point of this? Like, I mean, you might as well just come into the stadium, lads, because this is ridiculous. But people apparently had put up some posters and banners and things, you know, sort of suggesting they were getting a bit annoyed at Roy Hodgson. To which Roy cancels caution. 73-year-old Roy says, people need to be careful. When Alan Kirbishley left Charlton many years ago, they were constantly in the top half of the table. It was because fans were not happy and thought that finishing the top half wasn't enough and that they needed to kick on. They did. They kicked downwards. And that is the only problem. You have to be careful. That's part and parcel of our football life. So he used the example of Alan Kirbishley. He could have used the example of Tony Pulis at Stoke. A similar type of situation, I suppose. Be careful what you wish for, councils, Roy. His contract is up, though, in the summer. And, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
See if you don't get a result at Motherwell, you're away, mate. Your bags and your desk, boom.
Your bags and your desk, boom.
I mean it, I'm fucking raging, speaking from my heart. Who would I want in? I've got big Terry Butcher in.
Mr. Tate, how you doing?
Not too good after tonight. You got the job on the technicality of a legend who recommended you.
Take no beat, I take no beat, I take no, I take no, I take no beat. Just so soft, don't try to get so deep. You know me, but I can't yell me, I can't yell me, I can't yell me, I can't yell, can't yell, can't yell me.
You have lost the fans tonight. You don't deserve the fans.
Listen to fans. Just need to fucking work on it.
You are nothing, you are a fool, and you are a waste of time. Good night.
Oh, the Guinness Book of Records, stop. Get a grip!
He's the biggest fool in Manchester.
It's Jonathan Wilson and Dion Fanning today. And I think I'll start, Dion, by being a little bit biased from an Irish point of view and put it to you that it's nice to see Seamus Coleman involved in that rare Merseyside derby win for Everton at the weekend. And not just involved, he was a central part of this Ancelotti tactical masterclass, as he revealed afterwards. Another way of putting this is that old Father Time released his icy grip on Seamus Coleman's throat to allow the Republic of Ireland skipper to snuff out Andy Robertson, Dion.
Yeah, he was excellent as part of, a game plan that worked, you know, supremely well against Liverpool. And, you know, Ancelotti deserves a lot of credit for that. But it was a game plan that basically was, you know, have you watched Liverpool play over the last 6 weeks? And this is how you stop them. And, you know, Everton defended deep, played, helped by an early goal. And then asked Liverpool to try and do something rather than doing what they do at the moment a lot, which is play the ball very ponderously and with a kind of lack of movement about them. But Everton were exceptional, and Coleman was one of a number of really good performances, and it was just a shame that he didn't score with that header.
Were Everton actually exceptional, Jonathan? Or did they need to be exceptional to create this bit of history, or did they just need to be solid and professional given where Liverpool are at?
I suppose somewhere between the two. I mean, given where Liverpool are, clearly solidity and professionalism have been enough. You know, I mean, four defeats at home in a row suggest you don't need to do anything that special to beat them. But I think with it being a derby, with the recent record between the sides, but it's not even a recent record, is it? The kind of the Everton's failures to win at Anfield, to get over that psychological hurdle, and I think actually they didn't need to be exceptional in that they did exactly what they needed to do, which was to get the early goal, and from then on they pretty much controlled the game. So no, they weren't exceptional, but given they didn't need to be exceptional, not being exceptional was exceptional in that showed exceptional game management, if that makes sense.
A certain amount.
I thought it was kind of extraordinary. Like, I do think there was something, you know, Everton did need to do something because of their own record, because, you know, okay, Liverpool have lost, you know, to so many teams that, you know, you don't need to make a case for it being extraordinary or anything to beat them. But because of Everton's record, like, I thought it was amazing, like, beforehand, you know, Seamus Coleman, when he was interviewed, they brought up, like, you know, you were part of the team in 2010 that won. And, you know, 2010 is a long time ago. And, like, the interviewer, I think it was Jeff Shreves, clutching at straws. But that, you know, that shows everyone that this, it can be done, can't it? And it was kind of, you know, extraordinary way to frame something that had happened 11 years ago. So, like, they were carrying a huge weight of history, Everton. So it did require something kind of, you know, they did require a sort of an organisational discipline, which Ancelotti gave them.
I thought that was weird as well when they said, because it's like, have you, like, Liverpool are losing every game at the moment. I mean, this notion that, like, oh, it's going to be so difficult, or, like, you know, that you, it'll be a struggle for you to believe. Of course they know that they could win. But I wonder what you think the ceiling is for Everton at the moment, because when you look at them, I mean, at the moment they're level with Liverpool with a game in hand. Were they to win that game in hand, then they would be, I think, level with Chelsea, who are just outside the top four. But when you look at their actual, what this means is that Everton are at last beginning to catch up with their own investment, because the performance has trailed the investment for some time. Like, if you look at the last five seasons, Everton are actually third in the net spend table over that time, but behind the two Manchester clubs, ahead of Chelsea. They're behind Chelsea in absolute spending, but ahead of them in net spend, because Chelsea also sell players for big prices, which Everton haven't really done, because, well, I mean, there's been a couple, I suppose, I think of Lukaku, but, you know, it's a pretty elevated position in spending. Do you think there is the possibility here of a kind of a long-term shift? I mean, everyone's got used to thinking of Liverpool being well ahead of Everton, but the spending hasn't reflected that, is what I'm saying. And is there a possibility of Everton turning that around?
I don't know about a long-term shift, but I think this season, when you look at the top of the table, there is no reason why Everton can't, say, you know, set themselves a standard of finishing ahead of West Ham, for example, given what you said. I would be reluctant to kind of say anything about any long-term shifts in relation to this season, because I think it's a freak season in so many ways that I suspect that it'll be very quickly forgotten about. But there's definitely a reason for Everton to feel that they can actually, you know, finish in the top four this season.
And I mean, I think in terms of long-term shifts, you know, the reason the big six are the big six, it's not necessarily to do with the squad they have now or the manager they have now. It's to do with the sort of the infrastructure that they have. And I guess when, you know, that's why Leicester is sort of an addition to the big six, because the stadium is half the size of the others. So yes, over a shortish period, they can maybe match the spending of certain other sides. But long-term, that's not really sustainable.
Well, they're building a new, they're building a new stadium and all that as well. So
yeah, and so maybe when that is bedded in, then that improves Everton's stature. But we also see that certainly in the short term, moving to a new stadium can create issues with revenue flow, which we've seen with Arsenal and with Tottenham. So in the long term, yes, but I mean that long term, we're probably talking another decade down the line.
Dion, I think you were writing this week in Currency about an article along the lines of, if people think this is a crisis, just imagine how much worse things could get without Jurgen Klopp. Why does the thought of Liverpool without Jurgen Klopp occur to you? Because he has a contract until 2024, which is, you know, 3 years away. So why would anyone be thinking now about Liverpool without Jurgen Klopp?
Well, I think the recent results and the sort of the sense last week after the Leicester defeat that, you know, Klopp, people were talking about Klopp needing time off and these sort of things that obviously he rejected, and you know now like the and there are always some corners of the internet where people will want change and want it fast. And I think even since the weekend, then there's been some suggestions that, you know, the what happened at Dortmund could be happening at Liverpool. That the system is failing Liverpool, and I just felt that it was important to make the point that, you know, there was a lot of people at Liverpool and the structure of Liverpool and given credit for what Liverpool achieved over the last couple of years, but I don't think any of it would have been possible without Klopp to knit that all together and to actually create a framework because of his gifts as a manager, which include making other people feel that they should be getting the credit for what he has done. Without those gifts, I don't think it would have happened. So if Liverpool think that this structure allows them to kind of slot in another manager and things will go on because, you know, Michael Edwards is going to find the right players and all these factors that are part of Liverpool's success now, I think that would be a dangerous mistake to make. So I think it's just something that I feel is worth stating at this point.
Couldn't do much worse than 2 wins in 8, though, could they?
Well, like, you see, four
home defeats in a row. I mean, this is, you know, no one, scarcely anyone alive today could remember the last time Liverpool were this bad at Anfield.
But this season is not. I think this season, isn't the season to judge Liverpool. I think the fact that they've achieved all that they've achieved over the last couple of years, and then they came into a season like this one with a short pre-season, all the things we've laid out before, empty stadiums. A soulless kind of atmosphere, just a grim relentlessness about everything. Now, everyone makes the argument, but it's been the same for everybody else. But everybody else hasn't had the last 2 or 3 years that Liverpool have had. So other people were flailing around other seasons, and they were flailing around. Liverpool were at a kind of level of high intensity that I don't think could be sustained in the circumstances of this season. So if the situation is the same next season, maybe you can say, right, is what happened at Dortmund happening at Liverpool? But right now, I think everything that has been achieved up until now is much more important for Liverpool to consider when they're looking at what's going to happen. And I think it may be that what's happened this season has accelerated the need to actually evolve the team and to change the team, and that's something that is probably true. I think maybe without a pandemic, you might have got another year or two out of the players that Liverpool had, partly because they may have been less reluctant to spend money in the transfer market, and they would have been able to bring in players that are suitable replacements for the front three. But apart from that, I think it would be a very short-term and dangerously short-term thinking to actually think, right, something fundamental like getting a different manager is the answer.
I mean, there does have to be some accountability, though, surely, Jonathan. I mean, this is, you know, this has been a total disaster, you know, and you know, maybe you could say, okay, Klopp's done enough to earn the right for one more chance, let's say. Is that true of all the players? I mean, the risk is you could say, well, you know, you can't really judge us on this season. We need to go to the next season. But like, if you go to the next season with a similar team and it turns out they get quite similar results, then you end up looking a bit stupid. So, you know, if you were Michael Edwards thinking, how does this team most obviously need to be reshaped for next season so the same thing doesn't happen again? What's the first item on your list?
Well, they need to bring an extra cover at centre-back. I mean, clearly they did go in probably one central defender short this season. And, but I mean, having said that, if you lose all three of your recognised centre-backs and then the two players who you've dropped back in midfield to cover for them, that's a very, very strange concentration of injuries that, you know, I don't think anybody could realistically... You know, but you shouldn't plan for. You shouldn't have seven first-choice centre-backs. That would be absurd. So I think they've been really unfortunate with that. You know, when I was on with Melissa Reddy, we were talking about how they have tried to evolve the team, bringing in Diogo Jota, bringing in Thiago. There has been an attempt there to evolve the style and to evolve that front three to head off that sort of entropy you seem to get after the three-year cycle. And again, injuries have scuppered that. So I guess if you're being... Yeah, there's obviously the sort of the loyalty to Klopp, the sense he has credit in the bank, the sense that, you know, he deserves another chance. I get all of that. I think even on a very... what's the word I'm looking for? A very sort of a cold, sort of materialistic level. You're going to have to change this squad. Yeah, this it's the oldest squad in Premier League. You know, that's already the case. If you weight it by minutes played, so you already have the older squad in the Premier League that's had this 3-year cycle that's complete. They need a change. So you're going to have to change. Bring in, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 players anyway. Do you want to be doing that with a new manager? Or do you want to do that with the bloke who is deeply connected to the city, who's already proved he can do it, who you know can end a 30-year wait for a title? And I think that's sort of the problem Tottenham got themselves into, that they sort of thought, well, this phase of the project has run out of steam. We need to make a change. They get rid of Pochettino, they bring in Mourinho, and actually it turns out we need to change all the players anyway. So I struggle to see the arguments for getting rid of Klopp beyond just a knee jerk. Something needs to be done. This is something. Therefore, we should do it.
Another comparison might be with Manchester City, where, you know, a lot of people were questioning Pep's future not that long ago, whether or not he wanted to hang around, whether he still had the energy and all, and whether he was the right man to turn things around for Manchester City. Jonathan, questions that he's been answering pretty emphatically in the last little while. So today is the first day I've noticed this world record mark kind of entering. Maybe this has been knocking around for a while, but I've noticed people talking about this world record of 24 wins in a row. Man City are on 18 at the moment, so they're not a million miles away from pulling this off, which is pretty remarkable considering where they were around November time.
Oh, it's extraordinary. I mean, you know, they drew against West Brom on December 15th. And I remember having sort of a serious conversation. Is this the worst team Guardiola's ever managed? With, you know, admittedly a high bar. And I don't think that was a totally unreasonable thing to think, that a lot of players seem to have gone a little bit stale.
No, I just thought they were so far removed from what his teams had previously stood for that it must have been just miserable for him standing there thinking, what have I become?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he'd made that attempt to slightly amend the system, so they were playing with, you know, rather than sort of one deep lying midfielder and two more advanced, he pulled one of those advanced midfielders back, but that had caused problems with the press, which I think you saw really obviously in the game when they lost 5-2 to Leicester, that Nampalis Mendy and Tielemans were just sort of playing through the press because Kevin De Bruyne was having to do it all himself, and the press was getting there sort of, you know, half a second later than it should have been. And you saw all of that and you sort of thought, well, this is exactly what we saw against Lyon in the Champions League, that when he tries to temper his approach to make it slightly more conservative, slightly more defensively sound, it creates so many knock-on problems that the whole thing just falls apart, that he's, you know, he's tinkered too much, he's lost faith in his philosophy. And it turns out he knew exactly what he was doing all along, and just took a little time to bed it in. And now they look defensively as strong as any Guardiola sides ever looked. Now, that will, I think, be tested a little bit more in the Champions League. I think even the game against Liverpool, although they won it pretty easily, the penalty came from a simple ball over, you know, the top, the kind of ball that has caused City problems in the past. So, you know, let's reserve some judgment on that. But yeah, I think you have to give Guardiola enormous credit for the way he has been able to amend his approach, to adjust to the circumstances, to adjust what was going wrong before. And he's shown that capacity to improvise, which maybe other managers haven't. And you know, you make the obvious thing to do is to make the comparison to Klopp. And you know, intensity of press is a very difficult thing to measure statistically. But a measure of that is to look at pressures in the final third as a proportion of total pressures. So that suggests how high up you're enacting the press. And the previous three seasons, Liverpool and City were sort of neck and neck. You know, each of those 3 years, you've very little in it at the top. This season, Liverpool are way out in front with that. I think Sheffield United are second, and City are back in fifth because they have just eased back, and that has made them look much more secure. And it appears to have made them better able to handle the oddly compacted nature this season.
Yeah. Guardiola obviously was able to be very magnanimous towards his former assistant, Dion. He was talking about how Mikel Arteta is so good. You know, he's the usual way when Guardiola gets complimentary. Arsenal are 10th, though. And, like, I just wonder if you see much sign of, like, Mikel Arteta has been there for, you know, how long? Certainly more than a year. I saw the point being made by James Bang of CBS Sports. Arteta is calling out everything, right down to the passes he wants his players to play and where they should be standing and running. It has been constant. By contrast, Guardiola has hardly said a word. He doesn't need to. Should Arteta still need to be doing that, given how long he's actually been the coach at Arsenal?
Well, clearly, yes, until they kind of move up the table. I felt yesterday was a very face-saving performance from Arsenal. Like, you know, City set such a high standard, incredibly, like in the first 2 minutes, that, like, you know, Arsenal were lucky to kind of hold out for as long as they did. And then it just petered out, and Arsenal were able to go through a nice, you know, again, just sort of giving sort of the impression that they were going to rally, while City were completely in control. And I think there are signs of progress at Arsenal, but it is very slow. And I think when you come up against the Manchester City side, like, you know, City are at the moment, it may be that, and you start the way you started yesterday, it's going to maybe just keeping it to 1-0 is what you're, how far your ambition.
But isn't the problem, though? I mean, you mentioned, for instance, West Ham earlier in connection with Everton, and West Ham are fourth, you know, and they, you know, that is a standing rebuke to a lot of teams. You know, maybe this seems like a, you know, an unfair thing to say. It is unfair. I mean, David Moyes has been doing a good job at West Ham, but like, if West Ham can have 45 points and have scored 39 goals in the league, why should Arsenal be 11 points back and 8 goals back of that? You know, it's, you know, we can say, well, you know, Man City are a lot better than Arsenal. You know, Man United have got much better players than Arsenal. Leicester City have got much better players than Arsenal. Sure. Do West Ham really, like, do West Ham have more to work with? Does David Moyes have a better squad at his disposal than Arteta?
No, he doesn't. But again, like, there, you know, I don't think David Moyes is the answer for Arsenal either. Like, this is the thing. Like, there are certain random factors at play in any season, but there's certainly at play this season.
I hope that's not some sort of veiled dig at David Moyes.
I would never take a dig at David Moyes' expense. Manager of the Year title wrapped up by February. Look, there are legitimate criticisms to be made of Arteta, and, you know, a sense that he kind of manages to, and it includes this idea of him telling players what to do on the sideline, that he has successfully transmitted the idea of a successful, productive, functioning coach, whereas the reality is kind of lagging somewhat behind. And is that his would a different coach make it more of an impact at Arsenal? Would they have transformed more? Possibly, but there are so many aspects to what Arsenal need to do, and a kind of a whole culture shift at Arsenal that needed to be affected, and which Arteta, to be fair to him, I think has made some attempt at doing, but it's only really like this season has been so stop and start for Arsenal, but the reason for that is very hard to kind of to identify it sometimes. You know, it isn't just there are kind of legacy issues, I think, at Arsenal that they're still getting over, and I think involve recruitment, involve factors that aren't just Arteta's responsibility.
Jonathan, what are your thoughts on Arteta?
Well, I think this issue of how much a manager shouts on the touchline is a bit of a red herring. I remember very clearly being struck. I say very clearly, it's not that clearly. Was it Bayern or was it? I think it was Bayern rather than Barca. But Guardiola on the touchline at the Emirates, and it literally spent the whole game on the very, very brink of his technical area, shouting constantly and pointing and organising the whole thing. And I'd never seen a manager that involved in the very basics of how his team played. And I sort of, I went away from that game thinking, this is incredible. The energy you need, the intensity you need to think through every pass, every movement for your team. Now, obviously, on Sunday, City started playing very well, and so he doesn't need to do that. It's working. Whereas that Bayern game, he felt he did need to be much more involved. So to draw huge conclusions from how much a manager's shouting, I think, can be very very misleading.
They're not exactly inspired, though, are they, this Arsenal team, Jonathan? I mean, I'm just looking at that 31 goals in 25 games. I'm kind of like, Arteta, maybe you need to get out the way of these guys.
Well, I think you've also got to look at the scale of what he's trying to do. You know, it's... And again, I don't mean this as a dig at David Moyes, but the philosophy that Arteta is trying to implement is a more sophisticated, harder philosophy to get across, to instill in players, than what Moyes has done at West Ham.
Well, what actually now, is it? Because that is an interesting question. Okay, we'll just let's just see, what is he trying to do? Is it basically just sort of let's do what Guardiola does? Like, let's do that, or is there some obvious difference this stage? I mean, clearly the results haven't been anything like as good, but clearly his squad is nowhere near as good as the type of squad Guardiola has worked with. But can we, like, if you talk about Arteta's philosophy, what exactly is that?
Yeah, I mean, it is that, you know, he grew up at Barcelona. He's worked under Guardiola. It's clearly a sort of Guardiola light philosophy. I'm sure that if you talk to him, there'd be certain specific things where he has minor differences, but fundamentally, yeah, it's a juego de posición, as I'm sure Guardiola would call it, where it's all about controlling the game through possession and making sure that players are in the right position, making sure that they give options for the pass, that they don't get sort of in horizontal or vertical lines on the pitch. But I mean, that's a whole new way of thinking about the game that's alien to what Arsenal have done before, alien to what most of those players have done before. Now, the upside of that is very, very high, but it takes time to get there. Whereas the Moyes approach, although very, very successful at West Ham this season, I think the ceiling for that is significantly lower. So,
they're in the top four at the moment. I mean, that's as high a ceiling as anyone could expect from a club like West Ham.
We're
back in
division. But I mean, they're not going to be. Look, if next season. If at this time next year I'm back on here and West Ham have just won 4-1 away at Barcelona in the Champions League and they're all set to go to Champions League glory, then I'll take it back.
Yeah, but Arsenal aren't going to do that either with Arteta. I mean, the season. Well, no, but I think they aim to do that. They're not going to go any higher than fourth. They're not going to challenge
the
league under
this
Arteta.
I think in 3 or 4 years they really would like to. I mean, clearly there's a financial issue that. Manchester City and Chelsea particularly have much greater resources thanks to their owners. Manchester United have greater resources thanks to the fact they are Manchester United and they have all these commercial deals all over the world and the size of Old Trafford. So that's always going to be a a barrier to progress. But yeah, Arsenal are a wealthy club in a wealthy part of the world with a big stadium with, you know, tremendous commercial potential. They should be able to bring enough money to be regularly fourth and in a good season go beyond that. And if Arteta can do something equivalent to what Guardiola did at Barcelona and bring through this great crop of youngsters, then maybe the ceiling is that much higher.
So I guess just to wrap things up here, Dion, you're not giving David Moyes any credit for beating Tottenham on the weekend. I imagine that's probably, as Miguel, I saw posting on Twitter, well, this is the worst form of Mourinho's entire managerial career. So is that what you're putting that West Ham 2 Tottenham 1 result down to?
No, not entirely, but I do think it is instructive. Before we get all revisionist on David Moyes, like there was a difference of approach playing Spurs yesterday from West Ham than there was when they played Liverpool a few weeks ago, which I would have seen as a very much a performance in the David Moyes caricature, if you like, to be kind to him. Maybe it didn't do him justice to see it as that, but the kind of lack of ambition West Ham showed against Liverpool would have been the kind of performance Moyes' critics would have said you've seen an awful lot in those kind of games. Whereas yesterday they went and attacked Spurs, you know, helped by getting an early goal. But they had the kind of an aggression and a determination about them, which may have been the product of recognizing, again, you don't need to be a genius to know this, to recognize that Spurs are there for the taking. But I'm going to say you can't take any credit away from David Moyes and then take some credit away from David Moyes. But what David Moyes has done this season is very good, but I don't think anything that happens this season can be taken out of the context. I think it's kind of absurd, really, and I know you end up sounding, it comes a bit of a broken record, you can't take it out of the context of the season. So it has been a great advantage for West Ham to be playing without supporters this season because of the nature of their supporters' relationship with the club in recent times. So I think...
So who is it? Which Match of the Day pundit or one of the TV pundits was basically making this point? Was it Redknapp? I think it was Redknapp, actually, who was making the point. Well, it translates to West Ham fans have been holding their club back for, you know, which is like a, I mean, I thought, okay, well, I'm not looking forward to your Twitter feed. I don't know if Redknapp is actually on social media, but like, this is the kind of thing that a fan base, you can imagine a fan base being enraged about. But I hear it said about West Ham all the time, and I know we've gone on quite a long time here today, but I just want to quickly get both of your opinion on what is it about West Ham fans that people continually say this. It's like every club you'd imagine would prefer to have their fans there, but apparently not West Ham.
No, I don't think it's exclusive to West Ham. I think West Ham might be kind of one of the more extreme supporter bases where you can say it, that you can say it about. But I think there have been times when lots of clubs have probably benefited from the fact that when things are going badly, they don't have the added element of support on their back.
But things are going well for West Ham.
No, I know, but just they've been allowed to breathe. These delicate flowers have been allowed to blossom in a safe environment before, without being exposed to the outside elements that it would be the West Ham support.
And are they unusually negative, Jonathan? I mean,
are they unusually negative, or is the environment of London Stadium unusually negative? I mean, it's a horrible place to watch football. I mean, it's horrible as a journalist. I assume it's horrible as a fan, as a journalist, because you're so far away. You end up watching it on telly anyway.
Upton Park, though, had the same, like, you know, Redknapp was talking about, I mean, he says he is a West Ham fan or was a West Ham fan when he was a kid. And, you know, it was Bowling Ground or Upton Park. It always had that reputation of, like, these fans will turn on the team. And I don't know
about that. I mean, I remember the season under Bilic when I think it was the same season, they beat Liverpool and City at home. And both of those were incredibly sort of raucous occasions where you could see the crowd having an enormous positive effect. So, you know, I think any fan base of a club where the fans have a reputation for being very noisy and very passionate, very involved, if that's a club that is not habitually in the top four or five. So that could be Newcastle, it could be Sunderland, it could be West Ham, it could be Everton. Yeah, there is a sense, oh yeah, they turn quickly. They don't. They turn exactly the same. You just notice it more because they're louder. Whereas at the London Stadium, because it's such a, you know, you get off the tube at Stratford and you blunder your way through the shopping centre, which somehow seems to change every time you go there. So the routes through are different. And it always, even though it's not very far, it takes you hours to get through that shopping centre. And even then you've got to go across another building site to get there. And then you can't find the entrance. And it's always cold. It's always grey. There's always a wind. You can't see. It's a horrible place to play football.
What a whinge. You can't see. What do you mean you can't see? What are you talking
because
about?
Because the press box is probably 80 yards from a near touchline.
Right.
So if anything happens in the box, it's 120 yards away. So you end up just watching the game on telly anyway. So if you're a fan, you don't have the telly. So I don't know how fans behind one of the goals, it must be almost, you know, getting on for 160, 170 yards, maybe even more if you're at the back of the stand to the goal mouth at the other end. So,
yeah, I don't think you can argue. I think the stadium is soulless and it's depressing. And then it also comes with the baggage of what it sort of means as an emblem of the relationship between the West Ham
club and the
supporters.
I think the specific issue here as well, that, you know, there's no need to dance around this just because you're afraid of hurting my feelings. West Ham fans did not exactly welcome David Moyes back with open arms. They weren't exactly all on board with, you know, Moyes Mark II at West Ham. So if the fans were there, the feeling might be that they'd be getting on Moyes' back.
Well, West Ham lost.
If anything started to go wrong, and the fact that they're not there means Moyes and West Ham are able to operate with impunity and have been doing so.
What would it have been like? What would have been like? West Ham lost their opening game of the season at home to Newcastle this season. What would that have been like with West Ham supporters there?
I think the lack of popularity of Moyes,
even a man with the iron in the soul of David Moyes would have struggled to keep the fans on side if that was the opening day.
But what I'll say is, Dion, he'll have those irons fans in the palm of his hand by the time they get back into that stadium the way things are going. We'll wrap it up there. We've talked about West Ham long enough at this point. Thanks, Dion. Thanks, Jonathan. Great stuff.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.
He agrees with plenty, just it's always who's saying it, it's never what's actually said. 90% of anything is who's saying this, and 10% is what are they actually saying. So the 90% in Giles' case is, oh, it's that twat.
John is the best football brain in the world. If I could be that
guy instead of me. He just thinks I'm an annoying twat. I'd never let you do.
But if you're talking about the press, which you're talking about, have this opinion of Guardiola, it doesn't necessarily mean the football people have.
Yeah, I think I do like Ken Early's work. He writes fluently and thinks cogently, but I think he's wrong.
The press come and go, as we know. You mentioned Ken Early. Well, yeah. You know, I wouldn't necessarily agree with anything Ken Early says about football.
He just thinks I'm an annoying twat. I mean, you know, what can you do? Can't please everyone.
I do like Ken Early's work.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with anything Ken Early says about football. I'm mad,
but I ain't stressing. He writes fluently and thinks cogently.
You mentioned Ken Early, but I wouldn't necessarily
agree with anything Ken Early says about football.
He just thinks I'm an annoying twat.
Twenty-four consecutive wins in all competitions was the mark set 10 years ago by a Brazilian club team, Coritiba. And so Pep is not too far away. Man City aren't too far away from that. Next up for them is the Mönchengladbach game on Wednesday night. And it's Atletico Madrid, Chelsea on Tuesday night. Lazio, Bayern and Atlanta, Real Madrid are the other games in the Champions League. So there's obviously Premier League going on a couple of those nights. You can be pretty sure.
Obviously,
there's Premier League happening too.
Yeah.
don't you worry about that. So anyway, if you want to be signed up to hear our Champions League coverage, then please do so on secondcaptains.com. It's a £5 a month plus VAT. That's it for this football podcast. We will have another little mini podcast out today, which is available to everybody. So keep an eye on your feeds for that one. Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you, Owen. And thank you, Ciarán.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Owen.
So there weren't any more mistakes, were there? I didn't hear you check anymore. I didn't hear you.
Well, I did check Ronaldo's debut. It was against Bolton.
It was against Bolton. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. I was going to correct it, but then I was like, oh, you're in a good flow and, fair's fair. You got it right. So still, well done.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Raven. Thanks.
Was it the right year, though, Murph?
2003. Yeah, come on.
I'm
going to get that wrong.
I didn't check the year, but look,
it was 2003. You can take that to the bank. Alan Kirbishley was still manager of Charlton at that time. I remember it well.
More on this tomorrow if it was any year other than 2003.
Thanks, guys.
What form is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.